You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire Maronga irirangi poho mō tēnei rā, te rā. Rua te kau o rima o hui tanguru. Kia ora, you're tuned into the Thursday Wire with me, Justin Wong, on 95BFM. Today is Thursday the 25th of February. I am in studio with, as usual, with my trusty producer, Ayana Piperhelion.
Kia ora.
Kia ora. How has it been?
Yeah, it's been good, thank you. It's great to be in the studio. Great to be on The Wire as usual every week.
Yes, as of nothing has happened.
No fire.
Nothing happened whatsoever. FIKNA, on the show today, we have our regular updates with Health Minister Andrew Little and Over the Ditch with Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandis on Neighbourhood Watch. While the government has amended the KiwiSaver Act to allow people with life-shortening disability conditions to access it early, Ayana spoke to activist Timothy
Fairhall. I talked to him this morning on his way to Parliament. He was very excited. And as well, I spoke to the Director of Advocacy for IHC, Trish Grant. And also, Justin, you chatted to the man in charge of this,
yes,
Dr. David Clark.
I spoke to the Minister for Consumer Affairs, for Commerce and Consumer Affairs, David Clark. As usual, aha o whakaro, you can get into touch with me and Ayana by the phone. It's 309-3879 or by text on 5395. And as usual, you can re-catch all these stories or the previous ones on the 95BFM website. Now, let's catch up with the Health Minister.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about the government's mental health policy. Here's the Minister.
This week, I just want to focus on mental health policy from the government. So we have heard a lot on other media from mental health NGOs and former practitioners saying that there are a lot of problems with the existing mental health system and it is severely underfunded. But you said on Tuesday on RNZ that mental health services are already improving. So what, I just want to know, why do you say this?
Because that's what people in the sector are telling me, but it's also consistent with the additional investment that we're putting into the sector. We made the commitment in the 2019 budget to put $1.9 billion over 4 years into the sector. $1.1 billion of that is health money. The rest is goes to other departments and agencies dealing with the social determinants of health, so putting more money into employment, into housing, into corrections and justice to deal with issues there to do with mental health. Of the $1.1 billion, we're due to have spent by the 30th of June this year $350 million. As at the end of last year, we'd spent roughly $280 million. I know that the big issue that the review of mental health conducted in 2018 talked about was the lack of support and services for mild to moderate mental health issues. That's been the priority. And as at the end of last year, we put in nearly $100 million out of $145 million due to be spent by the 30th of June this year. That stuff is starting to make a difference. There are literally thousands of people each month getting access to talk therapies and that kind of low-level intervention that previously they weren't getting access to.
Well, we're 18 months into the four-year program implementing He Ara Oranga recommendations. Are you confident that the government can complete all the recommendations by the end of the four-year program?
Yes, I am. Bearing in mind that some of them are related to workforce issues, workforce development issues, so there's a question about taking people who are existing health practitioners or not doing health disciplines who have the opportunity to have some additional training to enable them to take up mental health roles. Then there are people who, you know, we've got to start from scratch from to get into roles as well, clinical psychologists, psychiatrists and others. And, of course, that's, you know, multi-year kind of program to develop. But there are, you know, there are more people employed in the mental health sector, engaged in the mental health sector, than there were 18 months ago. We know that at the acute end, so people who are really unwell, we have to upgrade and in some cases rebuild facilities around hospitals. We've had four proposals to do that. Five have been approved. Five proposals, four have been approved, and four of those four that have been approved are in the construction design phase. So it will take the full 4 years and possibly even 5 years to fully see out and realise the benefits that, you know, that we've made the decision to invest in.
But out of the 38 recommendations that the government accepted it will implement from Her Ara Oranga, how many have been implemented so far? Is there a number on this?
Well, they've all been started. I mean, you could say the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission has been established. That was up and running from the 9th of February this year. A lot of them, there's recommendations about kind of process issues, the long-term stuff, and then there's the investment stuff to turn it around, put more money into the system, a net addition to the system to ensure that there are more services not previously available are actually provided. Work on all the recommendations has started, but the nature of some of them is that they are long term, so they're not going to be concluded at this particular point. You wouldn't expect in a 4 year program for everything to be done within 18 months.
Right, then after the 4 year program, the government so far hasn't got a long term program after that. Could we see a plan for that?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, a lot of the additional money that has gone into the system and will go into the system over that four-year program will be what they call baseline. So it'll become a permanent feature of the funding for the system, because it has to, because there's clearly a need for those services. They weren't there before they put in place. In terms of the broader long-term plan, you know, both the initial Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission and the outgoing Mental Health Commission, it says there needs to be like a long-term 10-year plan. Like, that work is underway on that. That's a comprehensive piece of work because it needs to involve the engagement of the sector. So it'll take a while to pull that together. We gave priority to making sure that there were additional services available that previously weren't there. That's what we've done with what we call the access and choice. So those people needing access to talk therapies for mild to moderate mental health issues, we gave that priority because that was stuff that was desperately needed. It wasn't there before. We've got that in place. That's continuing to roll out. The long-term stuff, of course, that needs to happen, and that is happening now too, but you know, that takes a while to get around the sector and get people's input into it.
Speaking of the Mental Health Foundation, they have claimed that Ministry of Health officials told them not to criticise the government because it accepts money, and in particular, there is a clause in their contract with the ministry saying there is a no surprise clause that neither partner can criticise each other without discussing the matter of concerns. So what do you say, think? Do you have anything to comment on that?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a beat up there. The Mental Health Foundation did make a statement that was critical of the government. That's entirely their prerogative. They're an independent organisation. Certainly as Minister, I've never taken the view that just because you receive government funding you can't criticise the government if you think it's justified in doing so. I understand a ministry official contacted the Mental Health Foundation after the ministry had received the statement but before it had gone public and had a conversation about it. I can understand how that was interpreted as some sort of giving them an impression that they shouldn't say it. I'm satisfied from my discussions with the Ministry of Health officials that wasn't either what happened or what was intended. But nevertheless, I still think there's, you know, it's legitimate to ask the question about whether that particular call should have taken place at that time anyway. Nevertheless, it is what it is. I don't think anybody was suggesting that the Mental Health Foundation should not criticise the government if that is what they wished to do. The clause in the funding agreement that they've got, that goes back many years, I mean, the National Party put all these in the funding agreement some time ago, simply says that, you know, one should contact the other before going public with a criticism, not that they shouldn't criticise. So there's never been any question about stopping an organisation like the Mental Health Foundation criticising the government if they wish to do so.
Would you stop including these clauses in future contracts to avoid something like this from happening again?
Oh, I think to the extent there's a no surprises element to the clause, I think that's not a bad thing to have. It just means that everybody's talking to each other at the right time. Things happen, you know, for organisations that are funded by government. Likewise, within government, things happen and that you know are going to be made public, and you do want to make sure that everybody, if only as a matter of courtesy, knows you know, issues that could hit the media and would otherwise take counterparts by surprise. So from that point of view, I don't think there's a problem with it. As I say, the clause doesn't stop anybody criticising, you know, one side or the other, and that's as it should be.
Okay, and going on, still staying on mental health, your predecessor, Chris Hipkins, announced last July that $25 million will be spent on tertiary mental health services, but so far only $2 million are allocated for the 2020 to 2021 financial year, and this is more like directed to Māori and Pacific students only. So why was there a change in approach, and why did it go directly to Māori and Pacific students only?
The change in approach was how the ministry goes around letting contracts for that or contracting those particular services. The plan always was there was a growing level of funding. It's $2 million in the first year, I think 5 in the second, 8 in the third, and 10 in the final year of the funding package. So it was always going to ramp up over time. On implementation, it was accepted that actually the most in-need group of tertiary students are typically Māori and Pacifica. The greatest number of them are those in the branches of Te Pukenga, that is to say the Polytech system, and so it was agreed that an approach would be taken to make sure that those services were rolled out within the Polytech network, the Te Pukenga network, first up. The requirement is that the first services are available by the end of the second quarter this year, or the last, you know, the end of the financial year, which is the 30th of June. I'm very confident that everything is on track to make sure that that first round of funding, the $2 million, will be spent and services will be rolled out within the agreed deadline.
Right. Well, that is definitely important. How far are university, are mental health services based at our main universities going to get funded?
That'll be next, and I understand that the work is well underway dealing with the universities on making sure that the additional funding that's available to them, that there are additional services that have been agreed to and contracted for. That work is underway, but that is unlikely to come on stream until, you know, later this year.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire. Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia maronga irirangi pōho, that was Health Minister Andrew Little. You're tuned into the Thursday Wire on 95BFM. We are going on a quick break. See you in a minute.
What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
Dunno.
Okay, what about treasure trunks in Six?
What does that mean?
Shit, you're useless. Don't you know anything?
It's nice to hear you say it. I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's DJs Babyface Killer and Andy JV.
Oh, and tomorrow?
DJs Tito and Chip Matthews.
Sweet as. One of those actually sold 13 across. Cheers.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club. 152 Ponsonby Road.
May 1st, 1979. Engineering students at the University of Auckland are in hard hats and grass skirts, their bodies painted with swear words and crude symbols. This is their annual tradition, a mock haka. And when confronted by the activist group He Tawa, this will become the last New Zealand war. Auckland Theatre Company and Auckland Arts Festival present The Haka Party Incident, March 5th to 13th at ASB Waterfront Theatre. Tickets and more info from atc.co.nz.
Sorry, no goths.
Excuse me?
Yeah, piss off. Maybe without those sunnies you could read the bloody sign.
No goths. This is cruel and unusual.
Not as cruel and unusual as that beautiful velvet cape. Now get out of my sight, Nosferatu.
I'm a human being.
It's hard out there for a goth, but everyone's welcome on Penny's 1-4. A heady mix of the sounds of now and the shimmering hits from our alternative past. The 1-4 with Penny, every Monday only on 95BFM.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. You're listening to 95BFM. The time has just passed 20 minutes past 12. And what have you got, Yana?
Yes, so government announced today the 4 life-shortening conditions in which people can access their KiwiSaver earlier to enjoy their retirement. The conditions are Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, Huntington's disease, and fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So the announcement also included a process for people with other congenial life-shortening conditions to go through to access their savings earlier than 65. Because if you aren't expected to live long enough to enjoy your retirement after 65, the rule just doesn't work for you. So one person that this rule didn't work for is Timothy Fairhall, who has Down syndrome. Tim and his mother, Joan, have been advocating for this change for several years, and the amendments were passed last year. And today is the announcement of which conditions are accepted to access their funds earlier. So I called Tim this morning while he was on his way to Parliament to hear the announcement in person, and I asked him about where he was going.
I'm in the car and on my way to Parliament.
And yes. Why are you going to Parliament?
I'm going to KiwiSaver.
You're going to Parliament because of KiwiSaver?
Yeah.
And what have you been wanting to change about KiwiSaver?
Oh, it's just about people with have Down syndrome. About what would happen if at age 65 and they had to retire and people like me won't live much longer, and I like to follow my dreams, and my dreams is to see my brother's god from Italy, and my niece is my dream, and my other dream to see Thomas from Canada.
That's really awesome, Tim. Has it been hard trying to change the KiwiSaver rules?
Yeah, it's hard. Got a lot of people helping. Like my mom and also my family and my trust family.
How do you feel now that you've managed to change the rules?
I feel much better. It's all good. I'm so excited about it.
And are you excited to go to Parliament today?
I'm very excited.
What are you most looking forward to?
I'm meeting everyone.
So that was Timothy Fairhall, advocate behind the change to the KiwiSaver rules. Now, Tim has been working at Countdown for almost 20 years as a cleaner and has managed to save over $10,000 in his KiwiSaver, which he wants to enjoy while he's still healthy, which he's now able to do thanks to the change in rules. He wants to go see his brother in Italy and his friend Thomas in Canada. Now, without this money, he would really struggle to be able to live out his dreams, which would be the same for heaps of people with these life-shortening conditions, not able to access their KiwiSaver. So the Director of Advocacy for IHC, Trish Grant, was taking Tim to Parliament this morning, and I asked her about IHC's role in the changing of the KiwiSaver rules.
We have been really supportive of the call by Tim and his mother to have more flexibility in the rules around KiwiSaver. So we were delighted with the law change in 2019. Many disabled people require government systems and rules to be flexible and respond to their life circumstances. And this is a very good example of that.
And what's the importance of the announcement today?
So it names the categories of people who have a straightforward entitlement to getting their retirement savings earlier than 65, and it also creates a pathway for other people who going through their GP can also have that pathway and possibility of receiving their retirement savings earlier than 65. And for IHC, the fact that this change has been brought about by the voices of a person, Tim, a person who has Down syndrome, and his mother, and that they've asked government for a change, that's a great advocacy moment.
And when did IHC become involved in this?
We've been involved right from the beginning, and in fact one of our senior managers was involved in the working group, and someone from my advocacy team developed a research paper around what's the overseas kind of evidence in this regard, and collecting that important research evidence to determine that, you know, the decisions that government was wanting to make were the right ones. So this is an evidence-based decision, so that's important. And it's also a decision that's come about through a close and effective relationship between government and non-government organisations, you know, seeking to create fairer systems for people who need them.
Sounds like a great example of when the system has just worked well.
That's right. That's right. And it's been led by the voice of the people. So that's fantastic.
And is this the end of the road, or is what's next?
Well, what's next for IHC is government to do the work that's required to improve the health status of people with intellectual disability. They've received two reports at the end of last year that name the actions that need to be taken so that people with intellectual disability experience greater health and well-being and have a longer expectation of a better expectation of a longer life. So that's the next work program that we're interested in working with government on.
And are there other things in our life that we might not think about that impact people with life-shortening conditions where the rules just kind of assume an average life expectancy?
Well, that's right. I mean, if we think about the superannuation age itself, that could be shifted, could be lowered, because many people may not, you know, given their disability and health-related issues attached to that, they may not reach retirement age. So we would be, and that superannuation benefit is at a higher rate than the supported living payment. So I think it would make sense to think about how we could lower that age for people who have a reduced life expectancy or higher health conditions. So that's something that government could think about too.
That was IHC's Director of Advocacy, Trish Grant, and I spoke with Commerce and Consumer Affairs Minister, Dr. David Clark, after the announcement, and I first asked what changes have been made to the KiwiSaver Act and whether the government will make further changes to cover more people.
Yeah, well, you might recall that the government changed the KiwiSaver Act last year to enable people born with life-shortening congenital conditions to access their KiwiSaver funds when they choose to retire. That was a general category change, and today we've announced some more specific changes that guarantee people access to their funds simply by being able to provide a certificate saying that they suffer from a particular condition. And those conditions are Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, Huntington's disease, and fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So people with those conditions basically are automatically allowed to withdraw their KiwiSaver funds. People who suffer from other, probably rarer, life-shortening congenital conditions can still access their KiwiSaver funds earlier. They just have the one extra step of getting a certificate from their medical practitioner to say that they suffer from a life-shortening congenital condition.
Right, and how does this take pressure off families with life-shortening conditions and their families?
Well, what it does effectively is it just makes KiwiSaver fairer. It'll be a relatively small number of New Zealanders that are affected. But currently those people weren't able, or sorry, prior to the government making this change last year, those people weren't able to access their KiwiSaver funds until they were age 65. And for many of them, they don't live that long. It seems very unfair to pay into a scheme that you never stand to benefit from. So this allows them to take their retirement when it's right for them to do so.
How easy will the process be when people who aren't part of the four conditions that you mentioned earlier, if they have to go for a GP?
Yeah, it should be a relatively straightforward process still. That was the change that was made last year, and so people who suffer from some of these conditions may already have accessed the scheme that way. And so they simply need a medical expert to sign off that they have a life-shortening congenital condition.
Now, this is KiwiSaver, but will there be considerations for making the superannuation accessible earlier to those with life-shortening conditions or people with intellectual disabilities?
At this stage, that's not on the agenda, but I guess we constantly keep these things under review.
And speaking on that, now currently there are four conditions that are on the agenda that have been implemented so far. Is the government considering other life-shortening conditions but that didn't make the cut today?
Yes. So, this has come about as a result of a process and you know, going right back to the start, Tim Fairhall, who suffers from Down syndrome, and his mother Joan wrote a letter to the minister, then Minister Farfoy, asking for this change. And what happened from there was that the new general broad condition was created so that people, anybody with a life-shortening congenital condition who can get that medical certification can access their funds. And then there was a review done by the IHC in conjunction with Otago University to come up with a list of conditions that were common enough that really met this test so that it could be automatic. Now, that then was reviewed by the New Zealand Medical Association that worked. So there's been a robust process around coming to these four conditions as automatically qualifying. But I've set in place a system where there will be a review in 18 months' time because we know the scientific evidence is constantly changing and developing around medical conditions, and there may be more in 18 months' time that could be added to a list, but we'll wait and see what the medical assessment is.
That was Dr. David Clark, Minister for Commerce and Consumer Affairs. And as usual, if you want to let us know your thoughts on the story and others, you can call us on 309-3879 or text us on 5395. The time has just passed, 33 past afternoon. We will go for a break.
Mon cœur se dessine, mes perles me réclament, Paris me réclament. You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
This week on Neighbourhood Watch, Radio Adelaide's Zoe Cadendez talked me through about the federal government being criticised for only raising the job seeker benefit by $50 per fortnight, and updates to Brittany Higgins, the former parliamentary staffer who alleged she was raped in the ministerial office. We began by talking about Facebook reversing its ban on Australian news organisations. And a word of warning, parts of this interview discusses sexual assault.
So it was last week, just after I pretty much hung up the phone for doing this segment and speaking with you, that everything went haywire for Facebook in Australia. So Facebook took down all pretty much news, Facebook sites, in this big kind of tantrum that they threw because they didn't want to sign Australia's news bargaining code laws. Unfortunately, there were some pretty awful mistakes made in the deleting of all the Facebook websites. We had places like Queensland Health and South Australia Health, their pages get completely taken down. Also Western Sydney and ACT's health pages. We had Australian trade unions. We had Fire and Rescue New South Wales. And our Bureau of Meteorology gone. And then some pretty really clumsy mistakes, like the domestic violence helpline 1-800-RESPECT here in Australia and Women's Legal Services New South Wales were taken down. It was so unbelievably messy and clumsy on Facebook, and it really did cause a massive stir here in the country.
That's really problematic, but has it changed your way personally in how you receive news?
So I personally didn't use Facebook before this controversy, but, you can see the rhetoric changing here in the country, people's mistrust of Facebook, and sort of people were a bit, it feels like it was a big attack on everyone, in Australia, even though, it wasn't really, but, it felt like it was. So there's definitely a distrust and towards Facebook, but I'm not sure if it's going to entirely socially and culturally change the way that people in Australia receive their news. I mean, I can't remember the stats, but it was massive the amount of people who the only news that they receive is through their Facebook feeds. So, I'm not sure if it's going to change that just yet, but, I don't want to speak too soon.
Right. I guess this is a huge mess for either of everyone, but any idea why Facebook suddenly changed tack?
Yeah, so Facebook said it will be bringing back its blocked Australian sites for the news companies and things that were blocked. This is sort of after the government agreed to make amendments to this proposed media bargaining law that, would force major tech giants and places like Google and Facebook to pay news outlets for their content. So we don't know the entire details, but we do know that our treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, and Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg were hanging out and had some discussions and were speaking over the phone or whatever and trying to discuss this and get to the bottom of it. Facebook said it was pleased that the company could reach an agreement with the government and that their blocked Australian users, they'll start unblocking the site from the last week's debacle, and it's all already kind of happening. This media bargaining code is kind of structured so that if Facebook and Google did not sign the commercial deals with traditional media outlets, the treasurer could sort of force them to pay for access to the news content. So I've explained that quite simply, and it is very complex, please understand. But yeah, we're starting to see some changes to this law now, and we'll see how it changes more in the future.
Right. Okay. Moving on. Now the federal government has kind of increased their benefits, their job seeker benefit.
Oh my God, if you could even slip and say that. So this is probably the most ridiculous thing you'll ever hear in your life. So I don't know if you've all heard me harp on about the job keeper, the job seeker welfare benefit that we get paid here in Australia. So this is if you're over 25, I believe, and you're seeking work. This is the Centrelink payment that you'll go on. It's called Job Seeker. If we don't count the coronavirus supplement that we saw added on to the payment for about March to September last year, this rate hasn't been raised in 27 years. So the year I was born, it hasn't been raised at all. And then this week, we know that the coronavirus supplement has been decreasing slowly since September last year and will now end in April, on April the 1st. So the government have announced that they will be adding on an extra $50 a fortnight to increase the payment, and they've had a bit of a take-it-or-leave-it attitude. It's devastating. I'm mad, but it's really devastating. This still makes people on these welfare payments on below the poverty line here in Australia. So they will be getting an extra $4 a day, something like that, which still would make them under the poverty line. And it's awful. The unemployment welfare union and anti-poverty here in Australia have been pushing and fighting. The Raise the Rate campaign have been fighting for so long to get a raise to this rate, and $50 a fortnight is it's a disgrace. The government should be very ashamed of themselves, and they need to increase the rate more. And they've also increased the criteria for you to be able to get the payment. So, for example, I think when you're on it, you have to apply for like 20 jobs, like a fortnight, and they've made this criteria much stricter. And for example, if you are on Job Seeker and you go for a job interview and you don't want the job, they offer you the job but you actually don't want it, that workplace can dob you in to the Centrelink where you receive the payment, and you will get penalised and you will not receive your payment. So some really disgusting behaviour like that, that I just can't believe that this government can justify in any way. It's an absolute disgrace, and it's a shame for the whole country.
Right, so my recap on this. So the $25 in quote-unquote increase in JobSeeker benefit is due to the coronavirus supplement ending, and the federal government just transferred what's left to the benefits. Is that correct?
Correct, yes. So the coronavirus supplement will end, and then this $50 a fortnight will be the new baseline.
Now, there has been updates in the Brittany Higgins saga.
So yes, this next story, I'll be talking of instances of sexual assault and rape. So if you don't want to hear that, just turn down your radios for a quick moment. So the Brittany Higgins story has been developing a lot over the past week since I spoke about it. So Brittany Higgins was a former staffer in 2019 in Parliament House, and she has come out with her story that she was raped in Parliament House by a fellow staffer in Parliament, and I have to say allegedly. There has been now several inquiries that have come out of these allegations. So there's going to be a workplace culture inquiry. This was the first inquiry that was announced by the Prime Minister. And support for staffers, they're going to be doing an inquiry into this. They'll be doing an inquiry into workplace culture in Parliament. They'll also be doing an inquiry into who in the office knew of the initial Higgins allegations and when they knew and what they did about it. And then finally, there'll also be a police inquiry into this as well. So, Brittany has done an incredible job of rallying that all together, and it's her story that has helped catapult this massive change and look into Parliament. And we can only hope that this will continue to spark investigations and that these investigations get to the bottom of things and we can better understand how Parliament needs to radically change in its culture.
And I understand that as of yesterday, Brittany Higgins' former boss, now Defence Minister Linda Reynolds, has been admitted to hospital.
Yes, she has. So she will take a period of medical leave after more than a week of, you know, this escalating Brittany Higgins story. She was due on Wednesday to address the National Press Club, which was the same day Higgins was expected to make a formal statement to police detailing the sexual assault allegations. But the Minister's office released a statement earlier in that day saying she would take a period of medical leave following advice from her cardiologist relating to a pre-existing medical condition. This is particularly of note, not because it's just, you know, someone who's ill, but we've seen other Liberal MPs also move and come independent, and we're starting to see a few different people leave. It's just obviously very particularly interesting timing that the boss of Brittany Higgins is now on leave when this is all happening. So I just think that's very noteworthy. To know moving forward and seeing how this story develops.
That was Neighbourhood Watch Ripper.
That was indeed Neighbourhood Watch. It's 10 to 1. We're going for another break. You're listening to The Thursday Wire on 95 BFM.
All the way from Dunedin for a special one-off double bill at the Wine Cellar, Esther Rangu and Males. First Auckland show in 5 years, celebrating the release of their split single with fuzzed out up-and-comers Esther Rangu. Esther Rangu and Males, split single release, February 27th at Wine Cellar. Get your tickets now from Under the Radar.
Oh boy, Vista Foundation, 48 hours time.
The greatest filmmaking competition in Aotearoa is back, baby. Registrations are open now for Vista Foundation 48 hours. So whether you're an up-and-coming auteur, a passionate amateur, or you're real good at hitting record on your phone, grab your mates and get ready for your close-up. The shoot weekend kicks off 7 p.m. March 5th till 7 p.m. March 7th. Open to all ages and abilities anywhere in the country. Register now at 48hours.co.nz.
Tinnitus can be defined as
a false perception of a sound and the absence of an acoustic stimulus.
It sounds a bit like this. Otago University is conducting a study to better understand early-stage tinnitus. They're asking people who have recently begun to experience tinnitus to complete an online survey to help with their research. If that's you, register now at tinnitus.nz. You'll receive a token of gratitude for your time. That's tinnitus.nz.
Oh, my favourite jazz solo of all time. You know that one that's like boop it barrel.
Nah, I feel like they definitely improvise.
You guys still talking about jazz?
Yeah, just trying to work it out, man.
Do you know Grover?
Washington, Grover Washington, Limelight, great album.
Grover from the Muppets.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess so.
Does he like jazz?
All kinds of people love jazz.
The 95 BFM Jazz Show. Sundays at 12 with Blind Mango Chutney, Def Jim, Miss Dom, Francis Chan, or Dr. Mark Baines. The 95 BFM Jazz Show. 12 till 2 p.m. Sundays. Jazz, they just make it up as they go along.
That was The Wire.
That's all for the Thursday Wire today. And a big thank you to my producer, Ayana Piper-Helian. It's been fun.
It's been fun.
Nothing could stop us.
No.
Not even a fire drill.
Not even. No, I don't even know if it was a drill, Justin.
I don't know.
We'll leave that
anyway,
as a mystery.
The fire alarm came on right before the show was due to on air, and there has been a little bit scrambling going on, but I am very pleased that everything went all right.
Now they know our secrets.
Yeah. And we just had a text saying, I heard from a reliable source in Australia, that's Scomo New quite a while ago. I guess that was about the Brittany Higgins incident, and some media in Australia did report after Brittany Higgins raised the issue with her superiors, who then related, then the sources alleged that the Prime Minister's office was notified of the incident, but somehow didn't act on it. But there are two reviews going on, so we'll see more about that.
We'll wait patiently for the outcome.
Yeah. Sigrid is here with the 124. You're listening to 95 BFM. It's been a great run. I know some wires on the couple of days had a little shift because of the new semester here at the university, but Ayana and I are still sticking around on Thursday.
Reliable.
Very reliable.
You know, sticking to the Thursday wire. Best wire.
Yep. Nothing can move us. See you next week. Mate wa.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.